Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're embarking on really quite a fascinating journey into the human reproductive systems. It's an intricate, often surprising, and utterly unique part of our biology. We've had this incredible chance to dive into a series of lectures by Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman. He's an expert who brilliantly unpacks the anatomy, the physiology, and even, you know, the tiny cellular dances that define reproduction.
Indeed. And what Dr. Hoffman really drove home for us is that out of all the body's 11 organ systems, the reproductive system is unique. It's the only one with distinct male and female versions. So our mission for you today is basically to distill his incredible insights. Think of it as a shortcut to really understanding these vital processes right from the smallest cellular beginnings up to the full human life cycle.
Okay, let's unpack this biological marvel. Dr. Hoffman kicks things off with the male system. He notes it's, well, relatively simpler, anatomically and physiologically, compared to the female system. And right away, he challenges a common idea. What is a primary sex organ? It's not what you might think, like the penis. Dr. Hoffman clarifies that organs like the penis and vagina, they're actually secondary sex organs. They're essentially the delivery devices, as he puts it.
Exactly. The true primary sex organs, the gonads, are defined by just one crucial function, making gametes, sex cells. In males, that means the testes.
That's such a fundamental point.
It really is. And a fun little linguistic note from Dr. Hoffman. Testes is plural. One is a testes. Also unique to males is the testes' journey during development. Unlike female gonads, which stay put, male testes start higher up in the abdominal pelvic cavity. Then, usually they descend into the scrotum, that external sac, though, as Dr. Hoffman notes, sometimes they might remain undescended.
Right. And once they're down there, that's where the real action, the sperm production, happens. Dr. Hoffman showed us they're made inside the testes in these incredibly, like, convoluted tubes called seminiferous tubules.
Seminiferous tubules, yeah. He pointed out the name means semen-producing, even though technically the tubules only produce the sperm themselves, which are, of course, the most critical part of semen.
Okay, so they're produced there. Then what?
Well, from there, these young, immature sperm move into a network called the reta testes. But they're not ready yet, not by a long shot. Dr. Hoffman really stresses this. They need about 2 weeks to mature properly. This happens in the epididymis. Its name literally means on the twins, you know, because it sits right on the testes. And that maturation time, absolutely crucial for the sperm to be viable.
Okay, now here's where Dr. Hoffman detailed a pathway that's frankly way more complex than I ever imagined. The journey sperm take during ejaculation. That's not a straight shot.
Not at all. The mature sperm get propelled by muscle contractions out of the epididymis and into the ductus deferens, or Vasari deferens, you might know it as that. And this tube takes this surprising detour, looping up into the abdominal pelvic cavity. It even goes around the ureter, part of the urinary system.
That's quite a loop, isn't it?
It really is. And that tube ends in a wider bit, the ampulla, which is where it meets a tube coming from the seminal vesicle. Now, Dr. Hoffman explained the seminal vesicles add crucial fluid components. They're adding volume and nutrients to the mix.
So it's becoming semen now.
Exactly. This mixture then flows into the prostate gland. Its name means to stand before, which fits its position right before the penis. It's about walnut size, surrounds the urethra, and has its own secretions, making semen this really complex fluid.
And this brings us to one of Dr. Hoffman's key points about the male urethra. It's doing double duty. Uh-huh. It's much longer than the female urethra, and it has to handle both urine and semen, unlike in females where it's just urine.
Right. He breaks it down into three parts. First, the prostatic urethra running through the prostate, then the short membranous urethra passing through the pelvic floor, and finally, the longest part, the spongy urethra, which runs right through the penis.
And there's one last addition.
Yep. Just before ejaculation, as semen passes through the start of the spongy urethra, the bulbourethral glands add a bit of mucus, kind of a final lubricant.
Okay. And the penis itself, Dr. Hoffman mentioned the erectile tissues.
That's right. Three columns, two corpora cavernosa cavernous bodies. They look sort of dug out. And one corpus spongiosum, the spongy body. That's the one surrounding the spongy urethra. And it forms the head, the glands, penis. Erection is basically hydraulics, blood rushes into these tissues, drainage is restricted, pressure builds, and that causes stiffening.
He also detailed the glands, penis, the head, and the prepuce, or foreskin, which covers it in uncircumcised males.
Exactly, basic anatomy there.
Now let's zoom right down to the cellular level. This is where Dr. Hoffman reveals the really fundamental processes. Inside the testes, in those seminiferous tubules, we find spermatogonia.
Germline stem cells. amazing things. Dr. Hoffman explained how they continuously undergo mitosis, that's regular cell division, making more diploid cells, each with the full 46 human chromosomes. It guarantees a constant supply. One cell replaces the stem cell, the other moves on.
Moves on to meiosis.
Precisely. Meiosis, this is the special cell division. It cuts the chromosome number in half, from diploid tekent down to haploid N, so 46 down to 23 chromosomes. And here's a really fascinating point Dr. Hoffman emphasized. In males, all four haploid cells that result from one spermatogonium going through meiosis become viable sperm.
All four. That's quite efficient.
Incredibly efficient. And as we'll see, that's a huge difference compared to female egg production. But even then, they're not quite finished. They still need spermiogenesis. That final maturation step happens over a couple of weeks in the epididymis to make them fully functional.
Dr. Hoffman then stepped back to give us this really powerful concept, the human sexual life cycle. He explained that all sexual species, including us, basically alternate between two key processes across generations, fertilization and meiosis.
Right. Fertilization, that's the moment. Fusion of two haploid gametes, sperm and egg. They combine to make one diploid zygote. Dr. Hoffman defines this as the instant that mixes parental genes and officially starts a new human life, just one cell at that point.
And meiosis is the counterbalance.
Exactly. It cuts the ploidy, the chromosome number, back in half. It undoes the doubling from fertilization. This happens in the gonads, tests in males, ovaries, and females to produce those haploid gametes again. So as Dr. Hoffman reminds us, we as individuals are the diploid stage of the life cycle. The gametes, they're the very short-lived haploid stage.
And the sperm cell itself, Dr. Hoffman described it as this highly specialized little swimmer. It's got that long whip-like flagellum for propulsion.
Yeah, and the midpiece is just packed with mitochondria. Powerhouses. Generating ATP, the energy needed for that immense journey. He said it's like swimming many millions of body lengths to reach the egg.
Wow. And the head, of course, carries the crucial cargo.
Nucleus, with the DNA to deliver to the egg.
So how is all this male activity controlled? Dr. Hoffman detailed the hormonal axis.
Yes, the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis, the HPG axis. It's a classic feedback loop. The hypothalamus in the brain releases GnRH gonadotropin-releasing hormone. That signals the anterior pituitary gland, which then releases two gonadotropins, FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone, and LH, luteinizing hormone.
Now, wait, those sound like female hormones.
They do. Dr. Hoffman points out they're named for their roles in females, but they're absolutely vital in males, too. In males, LH tells specific cells in the testes, the interstitial cells, to produce testosterone. FSH acts on other cells in the testes, supporting cells, which are essential for the actual sperm production process.
And testosterone does more than just drive sperm production.
Oh, yes. Testosterone controls sperm production, develops secondary sex characteristics, and crucially, it feeds back. It tells the hypothalamus and pituitary, okay, we have enough, inhibiting GnRH, FSH, and LH release. It's a negative feedback loop that keeps hormone levels stable.
All right, let's pivot. Let's talk about the intricate female reproductive system. Dr. Hoffman outlines the primary sex organs here are the ovaries. They produce the eggs, the female gametes, and a key difference right away.
Yeah.
Female gonads stay inside the abdominal pelvic cavity. They don't descend.
Right. And similar to the penis, the vagina is a secondary sex organ. It's the receiving device for sperm and, importantly, the birth canal. Dr. Hoffman notes the word vagina actually means sheath.
Interesting. And associated with the ovaries.
Yeah. Near each ovary is an infundibulum. It's funnel-shaped with these finger-like fringes called fimbriae. Ideally, Dr. Hoffman says, these fimbriae sweep the ovulated egg into the funnel. The infundibulum narrows into the uterine tube, also called the fallopian tube, and that tube leads to the uterus.
The uterus, a major player.
Absolutely, a highly muscular, hollow organ. Its rounded top part is the fundus. Its narrow opening into the vagina is the cervix, meaning neck.
And Dr. Hoffman walked us through the layers of the uterine wall.
Three key layers. Innermost is the endometrium. That's the lining that changes dramatically in thickness during the monthly cycle. It's where an embryo would implant. Then the myometrium, myo for muscle, a very thick, powerful, smooth muscle layer responsible for labor contractions. And the outer covering is the perimetrium. Various ligaments, like the broad and round ligaments, help hold everything in place.
Okay, what about the external structures, the vulva?
Right. The vulva is the collective term. Dr. Hoffman described the labia, the lips. You have the inner, smaller, moist, hairless labia minora. They engorge during arousal. And the outer, larger, drier, hairy labia majora. Then there's the clitoris. Dr. Hoffman points out it's homologous to the male penis developed from the same embryonic tissue. It's highly sensitive. key to female orgasm. Much of it is internal, but the external part, the glans clitoris, is very sensitive and also covered by a prepuce.
And lubrication.
Provided by vestibular glands located near the vaginal opening. They secrete fluid during intercourse.
Dr. Hoffman also defined the perineum for us.
Yes, that diamond-shaped region between the pubic arch, the ischial tuberosities, and the coccyx. In females specifically, it's often thought of as the area between the vagina and the anus.
Okay, anatomy covered. But now, the cellular processes in females. This is where Dr. Hoffman highlighted some truly, truly striking differences compared to males. It's pretty mind-bending.
It really is. He explained that female egg production, oogenesis, actually starts before birth. While the female is still a fetus, millions of primordial follicles start meiosis I, but then they just pause. Arrested development. Most of these actually die off over time, a process called atresia. But thousands still remain by the time of puberty and sexual maturity.
So wait, while males make millions of new sperm daily?
Females typically release only one egg. Roughly every 28 days. Think about what that means. The egg that's ovulated could be decades old. It's been waiting since before birth.
Wow, that's completely different from the brand new sperm made constantly.
A massive difference. And Dr. Hoffman stressed another crucial point about meiosis in females. Remember how in males, all four resulting cells become sperm. In females, meiosis produces four cells, but the cytoplasm divides unequally. Only one cell becomes a large, viable egg packed with cytoplasm and nutrients. The other three are tiny things called polar bodies. They basically just contain the discarded chromosomes and degenerate.
Why the unequal division?
It's a strategy. The egg needs to hoard as much cytoplasm and as many organelles as possible because the sperm contributes pretty much only DNA. The egg has to provide almost everything the early zygote needs to survive and start dividing.
That makes sense. It's all about resources for the potential new life.
Exactly. Now, Dr. Hoffman laid out the female cycle as two synchronized cycles, the ovarian cycle and the uterine cycle.
Okay, let's start with the ovarian cycle. What's happening in the ovary?
Two main phases. First, the follicular phase. This is when those primordial follicles start developing. They become primary, then growing, then mature follicles. Usually only one follicle fully matures each cycle. And these developing follicles, they're producing estrogens.
In the second phase.
Luteal phase. This happens after ovulation, the release of the egg. The remnants of that ruptured mature follicle transform into a structure called the corpus luteum. That means yellow body.
Yeah.
And this is why LH is called luteinizing hormone. It triggers ovulation and the formation of the corpus luteum. The corpus luteum then becomes the main producer of the hormone progesterone.
Okay, so ovarian cycle, follicles grow, making estrogen, ovulation happens, corpus luteum forms, making progesterone. Got it. Now, the uterine cycle happening at the same time.
Yep, affecting the endometrium, the uterine lining. Day one is always marked by the first day of menstruation. Dr. Hoffman outlines three subphases here. First, the menstrual phase, days 1 to about 5. This is when the old endometrial lining is shed, menstrual flow. Second, the proliferative phase, following menstruation up until ovulation. The endometrium regrows, gets thicker, proliferates driven by the rising estrogen from those developing ovarian follicles. Third, the secretory phase. This is after ovulation. Progesterone from the corpus luteum takes over. It makes the endometrium rich in nutrients, very vascular, sort of moist and receptive. Basically getting it ready just in case a fertilized egg arrives for implantation.
The hormonal control sounds like a complex dance.
It's an exquisite interplay. Dr. Hoffman detailed how estrogen levels rise as the dominant follicle grows. This rising estrogen eventually reaches a threshold that triggers a massive surge of LH from the pituitary. That LH surge is the direct trigger for ovulation, usually about 24 or 36 hours later.
The LH surge is key.
Absolutely key. Then, after ovulation, progesterone levels shoot up, thanks to the corpus luteum. Dr. Hoffman pointed out the name progesterone literally means promotes gestation. It prepares the uterus for pregnancy and maintains that lining. Now, if no pregnancy occurs...
The corpus luteum gives up.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
It degenerates after about 10, 14 days. Progesterone and estrogen levels plummet dramatically. This sharp drop is the signal for the uterus to shed its lining. Menstruation begins and the cycle starts over.
But if pregnancy does occur...
The corpus luteum gets a signal, usually from a hormone produced by the developing embryo, HCG, to stick around. It becomes the corpus luteum of pregnancy and keeps making progesterone for the first few weeks or months. Eventually, the placenta takes over progesterone production for the rest of the pregnancy.
Fascinating. Okay, let's touch on mammary glands and lactation.
Right. Dr. Hoffman explained that breasts, or mammae, contain the mammary glands. These are organized into lobules, and within those are alveoli tiny sacs where milk is actually produced. Milk travels through lactiferous ducts, which widen into lactiferous sinuses near the nipple, and then out.
And he distinguished between making milk and releasing it.
Yes, two different things. Lactation is the continuous production of milk inside those glands. Happens in pregnant or nursing women. Milk ejection or letdown is the release of that milk through the nipple. This is triggered by suckling, involving a different hormone reflex, primarily oxytocin, two different processes, two different main hormonal control.
And breast size.
Ah, yes. Dr. Hoffman noted that in women who aren't pregnant or nursing, breast size is mostly determined by the amount of adipose tissue fat. The actual mammary glands are relatively small until pregnancy and nursing cause them to develop significantly.
Which brings us finally to the culmination. Conception, pregnancy, childbirth.
The grand finale, in a way, Dr. Hoffman reinforces that fertilization sperm meets egg, forms the diploid zygote usually happens up in the uterine tube. That single-celled zygote then travels down to the uterus over several days, dividing as it goes. It implants into that receptive endometrium, and development begins. Conceptus, then embryo, then fetus. He also mentioned the placenta, that amazing temporary organ shared by mother and fetus, handling nutrient exchange, waste removal, gas exchange, and hormone production.
And childbirth itself? Parturition. Dr. Hoffman used this as an example of something quite rare in biology.
Yes. Positive feedback. Most biological systems run on negative feedback to maintain stability homeostasis. Childbirth is a classic example of positive feedback, a self-amplifying cycle. As the baby's head pushes down and stretches the cervix,
its rich receptors are activated.
Exactly. They send signals up to the mother's hypothalamus. The hypothalamus tells the posterior pituitary to release oxytocin. Oxytocin travels in the blood to the uterus and causes the myometrium, the muscle layer, to contract more forcefully.
Stronger contractions push the baby down more,
which stretches the cervix even more, which signals for more oxytocin release, which causes stronger contractions. You see the loop. It keeps amplifying itself. More stretch, more oxytocin, stronger contractions, more stretch, until the baby is born. That removes the initial stimulus, the stretching of the cervix.
And the positive feedback loop breaks.
Precisely. The system then returns to normal negative feedback control. It's a powerful, temporary mechanism designed for a specific outcome.
Wow. As Dr. Hoffman walked us through all this incredible dance of hormones, cells, organs, from the male system's constant production to the female's precisely timed, sometimes decades-old egg release, and that powerful positive feedback of childbirth, it's just profoundly clear how balanced and, well, exquisitely engineered these systems are. It really makes you appreciate what an extraordinary biological feat it is for life to begin and continue, all starting from that single unifying moment of fertilization.
It really does. And this leaves us with something for you, our listener, to think about. How does the intricate precision Dr. Hoffman described in both the male and female systems, in the hormones, the cells, the timing, how does all that shape your understanding of life's fundamental processes? From the microscopic scale of a single gamete, you know, all the way up to the grand scale of generations unfolding,